Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week of January the 16th, 2017. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Nichols Patrick CPE, a division of the Los Galzo Institute, and your state CPA societies. This week, we're going to look at fake clients, real attack. And some of the things we're going to take a look at this week, first, as we tell you with the title, CPAs are going to find themselves under attack via phishing emails. We'll talk about warnings this week that were issued both by the IRS and by a major online portal provider involving phishing attacks. The IRS also published the annual limits for the cents per mile and fleet average valuation rules. We have a charity that got a ruling that its charges to other nonprofits will not subject the charity to the unrelated business income tax. And finally, the IRS goes out and wants to remind people about the ability to use transcripts in lieu of estate closing letters. The IRS is continuing what they started back in 2015, trying to sell us on the fact that we don't really want an estate closing letter, really, do we? Now, we've got a couple of things coming up. One thing I wanted to mention for those of you in the Portland, Oregon area is that the Oregon Society has added an update at the end of February for those of you in industry. It'll be at their offices in Beaverton in the Portland area. We're going to do a business and industry tax update, and obviously that time of year, primarily geared to those who are in industry. If you're in public accounting and you want to come by, it'll be fine. We'll certainly welcome you along. But the course is going to be geared to a certain extent to the idea of those who are in industry and want to look at getting an update on the things that will be important for taxes for those of you who are on the industry side of the equation. We'll look at those things that affect businesses. We'll take a look at payroll-related items and take a look at other items that may be of interest. So again, if you think you might be interested, that's been added to the calendar by the Oregon Society of CPAs. It'll be February 28th in 2017 in Beaverton, and I'd hope to see a few of you there at that particular session. Let's go ahead and hit our first big thing this week, which came out. It was triggered by two different emails that actually I got earlier in the week. One is from the IRS. It is a Security Summit Alert. A new two-stage email scheme targets tax professionals. That's news release 2017-03 that was issued on January the 11th. We also had an email came out just before that from Citrix and their ShareFile division, which also gave warnings about an email that was attempting to do phishing type activities on their accounts and that they warned people about. Let's talk first about the IRS's warning. Now, in the news release, the IRS came out, and many of us have probably already seen these emails, but if you haven't, apparently there has been a whole slew issued of emails that are posing as if they are new clients. And you get those emails from somebody who is looking for somebody to handle their tax matters in the area, and they found your firm, who knows how. They send you the email, and there's no attachment to that email. Now, as you may all be aware, traditionally our phishing escapades have always had the payload has been part of the original mail that came out to you. But in this case, we're getting a little more sophisticated. They send an email, and they wait for a response. If you respond to that email, saying, oh yeah, wonderful, I'd be perfect for you. I'm looking to take on clients. And so, yeah, go ahead and, we'll get your stuff going and you can send your stuff over, because they invite in the first email, they basically suggest that they would send their stuff. If it's okay, they'll send their stuff to you. The second email comes when essentially they then send you that information. Now, that information will have they'll either send you an embedded email address that's in there, a web address, or they'll send you a PDF that has a web address in it eventually that you're going to be asked to click on. Now there are a couple of ways as to it. The IRS does mention in some cases, some of these people have actually started sending out these emails under the name of legitimate people that they managed to compromise their accounts. So it could be a legitimate sender organization that they would have it come from. So it could appear to be coming from a real person. You could check that person out, find they're real. Unfortunately, of course, they're just using that as a cover to get it in. Now, even though you think you're grabbing their information or you're accessing a site with the client's information, they're really grabbing your email address. They'll attempt to get valid passwords, and get other information, they may also attempt to install malware onto your machine. So they could probably come up, and there'll be various ways they'll fake their way through to make it appear that you're going to give them the stuff they want to file the returns. Now, why are they doing this? The practical matter is, we've discussed this before, the IRS and the state taxing agencies are getting better at catching email, fraudulent return filers. We saw last year, the statistics told us that the successful completion of those had gone down last year. Well, okay, now they found they can't just go to the IRS the way they used to. Now they are looking at trying to find legitimate means of going around the IRS's various methods the service has to identify fake emails, or if I should say fake filers and fake returns. One of the key ways they could get around that is appear to come from a legitimate preparer with legitimate credentials. So they're going to get much more effective and they're going to try a lot harder to be able to take over your accounts with these services, or to be able to take over your equipment and be able to use that to file their fake returns. Obviously, the key time to file fake returns will come early in tax season, because you have to beat the legitimate taxpayer to filing. So because of that, we are probably going to see that over the next couple of weeks, expect these particular emails and phishing emails to come out much more often and start to increase. Certainly, we've seen a number of them already this year. The IRS recommends that you consider using internal policies or obtain security experts' recommendations on how to address unsolicited emails seeking your services. Certainly, you need to be suspicious of such emails. One tip the IRS put out in their notice was never to respond to or click on a link in an unsolicited email or PDF attachment from an unknown sender. We have to be very careful. My goal will be very simple: don't click on links in emails. Like it or not, and as much of a pain as that is, that's about the only way to be safe. And we can point that out because we're going to move on to a second case. Actually, this email I received slightly before the IRS put this notice out. And this came to me from ShareFile, from Citrix ShareFile, which is a service we use for portals. But I will point out that I also find that this same scam was being used with another sender, SmartVault, because I received an email that claimed to have an upload to SmartVault that was waiting for me to get this. In both cases, the what's going to happen is you're going to look in your email account and you're going to see an email to you that says there has been a file uploaded for you on your ShareFile account or your SmartVault account. Now, those of us who use something like ShareFile, SmartVault, most of these programs have a way for clients to upload data, and then you get notified. And the notification email normally comes to you with a link where you can just simply click on and you'll download the particular thing they uploaded. That's nice and convenient. But unfortunately, the bad guys have figured out that they can easily leverage that to enable them to either install malware on your machine by giving you an attachment you shouldn't have, or even better, get your credentials. Because if you click on the link, they either will deliver you the PDF, which it turns out has been set up with malware in it that's going to enable them to take over your machine, or they might simply put up a screen that looks like the login screen for your service. So you type in your login, username, and password, which is all well and good, except probably most of you have a number of clients on the service. And if they had your login credentials, they then can get on the service and look at everything that's been uploaded for or by every client you have. So you need to be extraordinarily careful. As I said, I had both ShareFile notice that they were faking this way. And I should point out, these emails do not come from ShareFile or SmartVault, but they look like the emails that come from ShareFile or SmartVault. And if you're not paying attention, it's easy to just click your way through those. They are setting up to try to come after us. I can assume that any other portal that's in widespread use by CPAs probably will be found to be coming under a very similar type of attack. In both cases, interestingly, ShareFile told us that the server that we redirected to was in Poland. On the email I got that claimed to be SmartVault, I took a look at the actual URL I'd really be sent to, not the one that was claimed I'd be sent to. And I discovered that one was also hosted on a server in Poland. ShareFile made, Citrix, I should say, made a note that they had asked for that to be taken down, and probably it has been taken down, the site, by now. But the problem is, it's trivial for these guys to move to another site. So again, you just got to be really careful out there. They are coming after your data, and expect them to come after it much harder in the near future. Next up, the IRS in Notice 2017-3 issued on January the 6th put out the annual limits on the cents per mile, the annual valuation limits on vehicles using the cents per mile and fleet average valuation rule. Now, these are the maximum value of vehicles that can be used under either one of these rules. And these rules are the cents per mile method as found at Regulation 1.61-21E. And the fleet average valuation rule is found at Regulation 1.61-21D. Now, if you're going to use the cents per mile method, and the cents per mile valuation is generally used, if you don't remember this, if you want to value an employee's use of a car for personal purposes, and you adopt the program that says they can't use it for personal purposes except for commute, except for, you know, various structures, you can use the cents per mile method. So, and I should say, actually, I confused that. That was the commuting valuation rule, which is a different set of numbers. This is cents per mile. The vehicles valued below this level, we're allowed to use this for a non-control employee. Now, the value in this case is $15,900 is the maximum value for a passenger automobile for which you can use the cents per mile method, and $17,800 is the maximum value for a truck or van. Vehicles that qualify for this, which are using this method, you simply use the annual mileage valuation amount, and you multiply that times the personal miles, and that's what you put in the W-2. Now, for those of you using the fleet valuation rule, there the maximum value of a passenger vehicle is $21,100 for 2017, and $23,300 for a truck or van. As always, these are set annually, so these will be good for all of 17. And obviously, in early 2018, we'll see a new set of numbers brought up for other, you know, for the same thing next year, where we'll get it based on that year's inflation. Next up, we're going to go to a private letter ruling, 2017-01-002. This was issued January 6th. And this is an organization that was asking whether what they were thinking of doing was going to subject the charity to an unrelated business income tax. Now, in this particular organization, we had a foundation that was a tax-exempt organization that qualified under 501c3. It also was a private operating foundation under Section 509A and Section 4942J3. It was formed for the charitable purpose of improving the lives of low-income children and their families in the state. And in doing so, among other exempt activities, it would go through the collection, analysis, interpretation, and sharing of city, metro, region, neighborhood data to help improve decision-making in the community. So essentially, they would accumulate data from various sources, they would put it together, analyze it, and then make it available to help with decision-making in this, you know, in their area for, you know, winning sort of policies that were meant to improve the life of low-income children and their families in that state. Now, it basically, many times, an organization, other tax-exempt organization, would seek technical assistance because those organizations didn't have the in-house technical or subject matter expertise to run the type of analysis that this organization could do for them. Now, the organization, if that other organization was involved in, you know, a similar purpose as this one, so it would achieve the same purpose by doing so, this organization, in many cases, would provide that technical assistance. It would essentially screen those organizations, similar to how it does a grant-making screening process, to ensure that to ensure essentially that it'll provide information and insight to advance their mission. So they're only going to do this work if it would advance their mission generally. But these programs, you know, and this work they were doing for other organizations turned out to be very costly, and it was limiting the amount of work they could do otherwise. So the organization sought to be able to charge these organizations a reasonable fee for the work that they were doing because these organizations didn't have their own inside staff to do it. The organization would, you know, set this fee, as they said, reasonably. And if an organization simply wasn't able to pay the full fee, they would also reduce the fee in some cases. Their question was offering this analysis service an unrelated business that was going to subject them to the unrelated business income tax? Well, the IRS took a look at this and decided essentially that in this case, their services were substantially related to the performance of the exempt function of the organization. So in that standpoint, they decided that it was not unrelated business income because this wasn't like going out, you know, and selling something just to raise money. They were actually, they made sure every time they did one of these, it would further their specific purpose. They wouldn't take it on if it wouldn't do that. So they ruled that this was not considered to be unrelated business income. Now, the other problem they ran into is because they're a private foundation, they also wondered, would they run afoul of the excess building business holding tax imposed under Section 4943? Now, Section 4943D3A excludes from the definition of a business enterprise a functionally related business or a business as defined by Section 4942J4. Now, that definition says two things qualify as a functionally related business: a trade or business which is not an unrelated trade or business, or an activity which is carried on within a larger aggregate or similar activities, or within a larger complex of other endeavors which is related, aside from the need of the organization for money, to the exempt purpose of the organization. The IRS ruled in this case they qualified under both criteria to be exempt from the excess business holding tax, Section 4943, because they'd already ruled what they were doing was not unrelated business. And the IRS pointed out that in this case, it was directly related to their exempt purpose. So in this case, the organization was told, don't worry about the unrelated business income tax, and also don't worry about the problem that you could run into with excess business holdings tax. Now, one thing to remember, if you work with not-for-profits, don't take this too far. There were unique facts here, but it does tell you the types of situations where you could probably get a positive ruling. You might also want to suggest to an organization like this organization, if you were going to do something that you think is like this, it may be worthwhile for the organization to consider investing in obtaining their own private letter ruling to bless what they're doing. Finally, we have Notice 2017-12. This was issued on January the 6th. And this deals with the IRS basically doing some cheerleading for something that they want you to do. Back in June of 2015, the IRS had announced they would no longer routinely issue closing letters for estates that had filed 706s. Prior to that date, the IRS routinely would issue a closing letter either when it had concluded the exam of an estate or it had decided it was not going to examine the return of an estate. Those closing letters gave comfort to the executor or the personal representative with the estate that they were, you know, effectively safe to move forward. There wasn't going to be an estate tax problem. And it also, in many cases, the probate courts or whatever state court was supervising the administration of the estate would also want to see that before it would approve the final closing up of the estate. Well, the IRS decided they really didn't like issuing those letters. They felt they were too time-consuming. So in June of 2015, they announced that they were no longer going to be routinely issuing such letters. Rather, they at that point pointed out that, you know, transcripts are probably pretty good and, you know, we're going to work up a transcript system. And then secondly, they said, well, if you really want to have them, we later determined that the IRS would allow you to get an actual letter, but you have to wait 4 months after your 706 has been filed before you can begin to ask. And if you're told when you call that they're not ready yet, you better just put another note in your calendar to ask again. In essence, the IRS was going to make this a pain. In Notice 2017-12, what the IRS did was now go onto their sales pitch for why you want to use a transcript. The IRS pointed out that a transcript provides current account data, and they even tell you the codes that you're looking for on the transcript to find that there's a closed examination of the return. They point out if you see code 421 and the notation closed examination of return on the estate's transcript, then that's the equivalent in the IRS's view of the closing letter. In essence, it has the same meaning as the closing letter did. So just like the closing letter, it would give you comfort that unless there was some major problem or some fraud that was uncovered, that the IRS was not going to reopen the examination of the estate return, even if there was still time to go on the statute of limitations. The IRS suggests that you use this transcript. They point out that it's free. What that tells us tongue-in-cheek, that's what it tells us by implication is the closing letters may not stay free. They may start costing you some significant money. Don't be surprised if the service goes that route. And number two, they've made it much simpler to request the transcript than to try to get the closing letter, which requires the call and bugging. Now, the one problem we've got is you may still find that the courts in your area or the attorneys who are advising executives in your area may still prefer that nice, old-fashioned closing letter they're used to seeing. If you do need that, they do remind us at the end of the notice that the estate or your authorized representative can call the IRS. The phone number they give is 866-699-4083, and there's where you will request your estate closing letter, but you can do so no more than 4 months after the estate filed its return. So if you want to get on the phone, you know these days getting on the phone to the IRS means spending lots of time on hold, and then you can see if you can get a closing letter yet. And while this doesn't say that you're going to have to call back later, certainly that's a very reasonable possibility that if they're not ready to issue it yet, they'll simply say, sorry, try calling back later and we'll see if we can issue one then. So obviously you need to be aware the IRS is pushing for this transcript approach. Certainly you should find out from the attorneys in your area if the courts are accepting this in lieu of that. That'd be question one. And then question number two is going to be, if they are the attorneys feeling okay and telling their executors and the personal representatives that this is okay to be used to make them feel comfortable that there's no longer liability? Well, it's just about time for tax season now, so I hope you all got all your, get your pencils sharpened, get your calculators and computers ready to go. It's tax season coming up. Your state societies will continue to be there during tax season, again, providing the support that they give you, hopefully keeping up on things that, of course, it's going to be a little tough for you to keep up, doing things like providing you with this particular podcast that will help you to keep up during tax season. And don't forget, once we finish that season, this is also the place you go to get your full-time continuing education. So be sure to keep up on developments with your state society of CPAs. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of January the 16th, 2017. We will post our updates during the week online at the website currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can check in there to see what we've been doing. You also should check your state society's website, as we said, for all the continuing education programs. There's still some like that Oregon program I mentioned earlier that are going to continue through January, February. And for those of you in industry, there'll also, for many states, be some that are even in March and April that you can sign up for. If you have any questions or comments about this podcast, you can go ahead and send them to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download the articles on all the topics that were discussed today at that same location. Again, go to the weekly updates page and go to the entry for this one for January the 16th, and you'll find the PDF there. You can also follow me on Twitter. My account there is at Ed Zollers on Twitter. Well, be sure to have an enjoyable week here as we get to the middle of January, and come back and visit with us next week as we give you the updates for items that occur in the coming weeks in the area of federal taxes.